Okay, Canvas here. Here, classic today is the late Toni Morrison's Song of Solomon. Song of Solomon. 1977, her third novel. Hi, Katie.
Morning.
Came out after The Bluest Eye and Sula, and it is the one that made her famous.
Yeah, the only other book of hers I've read is Beloved, which we talked about more ages ago, probably 10 years ago or something. And as usually happens with me with books, all I can remember is that I found Beloved absolutely incredible. And there was a scene with like pooling dark black sort of blood scene that just, yeah, that's my only recollection of it, but an incredible book.
I wish I could remember books better than that, but I'm the same. I know I loved it. Remember nothing else.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, so I wanted to do her book, obviously, because she's just died recently, and thinking about her legacy, but also, you know, whenever I read an amazing book by someone, I think, oh, I must read everything they've ever written, and then I generally don't get around to it. So good opportunity to go back to the well. And I think I never like to know anything about a book before I start it, and that includes I never read the blurb, because I find that blurbs can sometimes have spoilers in them, or what I consider, I've got a very low spoiler threshold. So I had absolutely no idea what the book was about.
So you go into every book with a clear brain.
As much as possible. Yeah. Yep. So, which, you know, does result in some strange moments. Like I remember when I read Anna Karenina and I was thinking she was on her way to the train station. I thought, well, I'm getting a bad feeling about this, but I just don't know why. So, so I came into this, no idea what I was expecting. And so I had a strange sensation in the sort of first half of the book where it's extremely character driven and I find it really compelling and really interesting and the prose is amazing. But I kept thinking sort of, where is this book going, if anywhere? Like, it's very much about
a lot of swirling characters going on, yeah.
Yeah, and funnily enough, because we've just done If Beale Street Could Talk recently, when I got to the end of the book, I think actually they've both got a similar structure in a way that you spend the whole first half of the book sort of getting to know a cast of characters, and then it sort of breaks open into quite an action-packed second half. So, her writing is just incredible. I normally hate it when people describe a book as poetic, so I won't do that, but it does have an amazing, the power of her imagery is just incredible, and she, even though the world that she's writing about is so foreign to me, you know, the domestic life of a black American family in the 1930s or 40s would it be, when it starts out?
I think so.
The imagery is so powerful and arresting that it makes it relatable and gives it such an immediacy that you really feel a connection to the characters even though their lives are so totally different than your own. So yeah, I really love her. I love her writing style in terms of imagery, and I love the, she asserts almost the very opening of the book starts by talking about names, and names become this hugely important theme in the book. So the opening scene of the book is one I still don't really understand, where a guy, some strange white guy, is threatening to jump off a tower. But we'll put that aside for a second. But the opening sort of image of the book is she talks about a street that's called Not Doctor Street and the way it came to have its name. So the first black doctor in this town lived there, the first black man of any consequence, she describes him as later. And so all of the black inhabitants of the town would refer to the street as Doctor Street. So the town authorities got a bit annoyed about this, so they put out an edict saying from henceforth the street is to be known as Mains Avenue and not Doctor Street. So they all then started calling it Not Doctor Street, and that's what it's still known as. And I love that sense, and it's such a powerful thing in the book, that sense of how language and names are an act of authority that you impress upon others, and all of the sort of complexity around power structures, names and language that come through in everyone's names. And they've all got these mad names. Everyone in the book has got these crazy names.
I was interested in, I don't know what edition you read, but I've got the edition in which Toni Morrison wrote a foreword, and she looks at the very first sentence of the book, which goes, the North Carolina Mutual Life Insurance Agent promised to fly from Mercy to the other side of Lake Superior at 3 o'clock. And she talks about what it's designed to do, and it's designed to carry a lot of stuff, that sentence, you know, to mock a journalistic style, The name of the insurance company is that of a well-known black-owned company, dependent on black clients. And in its corporate name are Life and Mutual. The sentence starts with North Carolina, closes with Lake Superior, so on and so forth. Mm. And what that meant was, as you say, that I read the book with keen attention to every name and every place,
yeah,
because it was so deliberate.
And every piece of language. I, of course, didn't read the foreword because I feared it would contain spoilers.
Yeah. So corrupt your pure brain.
I only read it afterwards. But, but yeah, I mean, amazing. And the names, so he, you know, our main character, who we is known throughout the book as Milkman, which he gets as a nickname early on, but his name is Mason Dead the Third.
Macon,
is it?
Apparently.
Because it's a place.
Doesn't seem right, does it?
No, but
I think they say
place.
Macon as in
right.
Bacon.
M-A-C-O-N. So, and that's come about, we find out, because his, would it be his father or maybe his grandfather, was asked for his name and gave, and you know, gave, in fact, the place of his birth. And then when they asked for his father's name and gave the place of his father's birth, which was Macon, and then asked where his father was now, and he said dead,
right,
but written down into the form that was written down as his first name and last name. So it's that sense of error, that's that sense of the other names. You know, these characters, the other children in the family have got names from opening up the Bible and selecting a name at random.
Like
so his
one
sister,
Corinthians?
Yeah, 1 Corinthians, one is called Magdalena, known as Lena. Another one, his sister, Milkman's aunt, is called Pilate, P-I-L-A-T-E, which is just so brilliant, bizarre and complicated as a name. And so, yeah, all of that sense of names and that kind of, and I kept thinking about, you know, sort of it as a colonial project, but of course that's with my New Zealand head, because it's not really it's not about colonisation, it's about the, you know, the results of slavery. But yeah, that sense of how language is occupying these places. And then right at the end of the book, when he's coming back from this odyssey that he's been on, he's looking
there's
out the window,
because it's a Circe.
Yeah, exactly,
as well.
He's been looking out the window of the bus and he says, you know, he read the road signs with interest now, wondering what lay beneath the names. The Algonquins had named the territory he lived in Great Water, Michigami. How many dead lives and fading memories were buried in and beneath the names of the places in this country? When you know your name, you should hang on to it, for unless it is noted down and remembered, it will die when you do. Like the street he lived on, recorded as Mains Avenue, but known as not Dr. Street by the Negroes in memory of his grandfather, who was the first coloured man of consequence in that city. And she really, I mean, in a lesser author, it would be a little bit irritating the way she kind of ties that all together at the end. But I feel like it's a book that just gathers in so much and is so rich and sort of arresting and imaginative, that when she has these passages that explain it, you're almost, you know, you can not only forgive it, but you're quite grateful that you're sort of bringing that coherence to it.
It seems to be about then finding your authentic self, culturally speaking.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of in some ways, it's a coming-of-age story, but it's just that it involves so much complexity because of, you know, the racial environment that it's set in, that it, you know, for him to sort of, Milkman, to sort of establish his identity, in a way he's kind of doing that on behalf of the whole of Black America. So it's, the project is so much more vast and complicated. And I hadn't really thought about it till I finished the book, but he goes on. So the second half of the book, he takes off on this trip, and it's kind of the reverse of the migration of Black Americans from the South to the North, because he's in the industrialized North. He starts off in Michigan and then he heads down and ends up in the South, and in, where does he, where's his
Virginia.
Final, is it in Virginia? Yeah, so he kind of, it's a kind of a reverse, and he goes into a much more rural kind of plantation environment, whereas he started off in the industrialized sort of city-fired North. But yeah, I think it's the thing I like about her writing is that, yes, there's all a symbolism, an incredibly rich symbolism, but it's never as simple as A equals B. So I think if you were studying this novel, you're never going to be able to say, yes, you know, Milkman's called Milkman because he represents, you know, the milk of human kindness, whatever. It's never that simple, and I think that complexity is a real strength.
We should say why it's called Milkman, because there's something vaguely transgressive about it.
Vaguely, yeah.
And it's, I think he was breastfed until the age of 4. And yeah. somebody saw him being breastfed.
It doesn't say the age, I don't think. I was kept looking to see what age it was, but we know that he's been breastfed until he's too old, quote unquote, to be breastfed. And someone, sort of this neighbourhood gossipy guy, looks in the window and sees this happening and starts this rumour. But then there's also this, starts this name, but then there's also the thing where his mother is later accused by her husband of having sucked her dead father's fingers on his deathbed. And Milkman himself ends up in a relationship with his sort of second cousin, isn't it? His cousin. So, yeah, there's kind of those there's incestuous sort of themes throughout the family relationship. So, yeah, so we start off, he's a little boy, he's getting his name Milkman, and in some ways it follows those kind of traditional coming of age things. He, you know, he's separating away from the family, he's starting to see his parents as you know, as adults rather than this kind of, you know, inseparable family unit. And then he befriends his sort of best mate, Guitar, and Guitar and him become super close, and they form a relationship with Milkman's aunt. But I think for me, the real pivot of the book comes, and it's almost exactly halfway through, where he finds out that Guitar has become part of this sort of, I guess, vigilante group that
they're called 7 Days.
Yeah, the 7 Days Club. And their kaupapa is that they will, for every black person who's murdered by a white, they will commit a commensurate murder themselves. So if a black woman is raped and murdered by a white man, they will rape and murder a white woman. And it's not, the way they describe it is that it's not around vengeance or a political act so much as it's kind of just evening out the population. But it's, you know, it's such a confronting idea. And then very quickly after first hearing about it, we discover that Guitar, who's been this really charming, roustabout sort of best buddy to Milkman and also to us, you know, we find him really charismatic as the reader, we discover that he's the Sunday man, and it's his job to take action after the girls have been killed in the church bombing in Alabama. So you know that he has to find 4 little white girls to murder, and not only to murder but to blow up. He's trying to source gunpowder to blow them up. So, you know, right in the middle of the book, there's suddenly this huge, you know, explosion of sort of potential violence, and it really blows Milkman's mind that this is happening. But it's a really, I mean, it's just such an incredibly powerful idea.
It's been pointed out that it begins with a flight, a doomed flight, by Robert Smith, who has wings on for some reason. So it's quite a complicated
never
thing.
Never understood, yeah.
But anyway, he dies. And at the end, it ends with a flight.
Mm.
And Milkman launches himself into the air. And it leaves it open to say the struggle ensues between Milkman and Guitar.
Mm.
And you're supposed to think, well, it's open-ended.
Mm.
I don't think it is open-ended because Guitar's put his gun down.
Yeah.
And so I think Milkman's going to be all right. That's what I think, Katie.
Yeah, I mean, I found, you know, far be it from me to be criticising the multinational book award, Pulitzer Prize and Nobel Prize winner, but I didn't find that flight at the beginning and the flight at the end particularly satisfying.
You found it contrived?
A little bit contrived, but also they didn't seem to really be strongly connected to the rest of the book, and I found the imagery in the rest of the book so powerful that I felt like they felt a little bit tacked on. But I think the thing for me as well is it's a personal taste thing, and I've never enjoyed magic realist fiction to a great extent.
Actually,
I really like realist fiction, and that's just, it's a taste thing. So for me, Morrison's writing, I love the most when she's writing in a realist mode, but she uses this incredible imagery. Like early on, she talks about his mother, and she says, you know, there's a watermark on their dining table. She never set the table or passed through the dining room without looking at it. Like a lighthouse keeper drawn to his window to gaze once again at the sea, or a prisoner automatically searching out the sun as he steps into the yard for his hour of exercise, Ruth looked for the watermark several times during the day. She knew it was there, would always be there, but she needed to confirm its presence. Like the keeper of the lighthouse and the prisoner manner, she regarded it as a mooring, a checkpoint, some stable visual object that assured her that the world was still there, that this was life and not a dream. And for me, that imagery is just so incredible, the way that it jumps from that quotidian object and piece of, you know, domestic damage to this sort of epic grandeur. And it brings this sort of beautiful poetic imagery, but it's still in a realist environment. And for me, that's the kind of Toni Morrison that I prefer.
We are being recommended to listen to Song of Solomon read by Toni Morrison. Wendy says, absolutely mesmerising and so richly written, and then read by the author. Check out an audio of this with your local library. Somebody else says, Song of Solomon was the first Toni Morrison novel I read. It was bewildering and beautiful. And Carol says, can you please be careful about spoilers when you review books? Now I know too much to want to read what sounds like a good book. Oh, that's very, very narrow-minded of you, Carol. And I think that most people will be able to tell you, for example, what happens at the end of quite a lot of classics. So
No, I disagree. I apologise. I think the spoiler alert is implicit. Never listen to these reviews. Just go and read the book.
That's right. Mm. It's like we said the rugby result in the news bulletin one day, and some woman shouted at us and said, how dare you? I haven't seen it yet.
You've got to go into news blackout.
Enjoy the weekend.